Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, and welcome to Lymphomation Live, brought to you by PAL, short for Patients Against Lymphoma. I'm Betsy DePerry, a member of PAL's Board of Directors and a 7-year survivor of follicular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The goal of our webcast is to give you another resource for support and accurate evidence-based information. And we invite you to visit our website, which is www.lymphomation.org, for much more. Before we begin, I just want to remind our listeners that we encourage you to arm yourself with information, but you should always consult your own physician to find out what's best for you. So let's get started. Tonight we'll be learning about the indolent lymphomas, what they are and how they're treated. Our guest is Dr. Mitchell Smith, who is the director of the Lymphoma Service at Philadelphia's Fox Chase Cancer Center, which is one of only 65 National Cancer Institute designated centers in the country. And this year, Dr. Smith was voted one of the top doctors in medical oncology by Philadelphia Magazine. He's received numerous grants for research from such prestigious sources as the National Institutes of Health. He's authored dozens of research articles, and in 2003, Dr. Smith received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Dr. Smith, it's an honor to have you with us. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to talk to you and patients.
Well, we appreciate it. You know, before we talk about the indolent lymphomas, how about telling us how you became interested in hematology oncology and about your program at Fox Chase and any particular areas of interest that you have?
All right, thanks. So I took sort of a roundabout route. I started out always being interested in science and medicine, and when I went to medical school, I also got a PhD in pathology, but really looking at biochemistry of how DNA and proteins work together. And then I was actually going to be a pathologist where I could figure to have some protected time for research and things like that. And while I was doing my pathology training, I made the mistake, I guess, of moonlighting in emergency rooms and realized that I really did would miss not taking care of patients. So then at the end of pathology, I went back and finished my medical training. And the question was what I would specialize in, and it just seemed like I was always interested in what makes cancer cells go haywire, so it just seemed an obvious thing to be interested in cancer. So oncology was a natural. And then, to be honest, the hematology part comes a little bit by when you're in training, a mentor sort of piques your interest and gets you sort of interested in an area that the mentor is interested in, and that was lymphoma. And it's a fascinating area because of the complexity, and having the pathology background was really useful. So it sort of came full circle, and then it was just natural to do, you know, lymphoma, leukemia, blood cancers as part of this. And then that allowed the research aspects to come in because it's an area where we can look at the blood. It's a little hard to biopsy tumors all the time, but it's a little bit easier to get blood and bone marrow to look at. So it was a natural mesh for the research and the patient care that I was looking for.
Interesting. Yep. So what about the program at Fox Chase? Would you like to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we are comprehensive cancer center, as you mentioned, and we're smaller than a lot. We're nowhere near the size of, say, Sloan Kettering or MD Anderson. But that allows us to do some things that they can't do because they're kind of big and unwieldy. We are very interested, we have been in over the years, in biologic therapy of lymphoma. I think we've learned over the years that chemotherapy works, but especially in the indolent lymphomas, as we'll talk about, that's has limitations, and we have to be smarter rather than stronger. So to be smarter than the lymphoma to understand the biology. So we've been interested over the years, obviously, in the antibodies. We did some work with antisense, gene therapy, interferon, sort of these biologic agents that, and we're still interested in these, as some of our protocols right now are new antibodies, either, you know, CD20 antibodies that maybe have different features than rituximab. We're very interested in a CD22 antibody that has a drug attached, and there'll be a abstract or presentation at the American Society of Hematology meeting in December that we're part of. That's sort of the where we're focusing our attention is antibodies and genetic therapies and those sorts of issues.
Well, they have all really given us a great deal of advancement in the field of indolent lymphomas, and a lot of us are here today because of them. So we appreciate your continuing that hard work. I want to add something else that coincidentally I just read this morning. It was an email from one of your patients who was very excited that you were going to be our guest, and this is what she wrote to me. Dr. Smith is an extremely intelligent, compassionate doctor with a good sense of humor. He knows lymphoma inside and out, and I've also heard that he's a great dad and a terrific soccer coach. So I just think it's great when we can add a personal touch. I'm not trying to make you blush.
Yeah, well, I did anyway, so. Too bad my mother's not listening. She'd appreciate it. But.
Well, that would be great. I'm sure she's proud of you.
Yep.
Well, let's dive right into this discussion. Dr. Smith, if I understand correctly, about 40% of newly diagnosed patients are diagnosed with one of the indolent lymphomas. So what exactly is indolent lymphoma, and would you please name some of the types?
Sure. So, you know, what I usually tell patients is, you know, first lymphomas come in B and T, and the vast majority are B cell. That just means they mark as and came out of a normal B cell and then became malignant, so it's a B cell lymphoma. And then roughly half and half of the B cells are split between aggressive and indolent. And the indolents are, as the name implies, slow growing, but and respond very well to treatment, but unfortunately, as of today, we don't think we can cure them. So our goal is just to keep them under control, and we approach them as a chronic disease. And if it's not bothering you, we'll talk about this a little bit later, we can leave them alone. And if they do start to act up, we can treat them. But so as opposed to the aggressives where, you know, they're potentially curable, so the idea there is to treat them as soon as we can. And usually with rituximab and CHOP, and then we cure a high percentage of those. So they're very different types, the aggressive and the indolent. Now, in the indolent, there's a whole range of disorders, and they have slightly different characteristics, some more indolent than others, but overall the approach is the same, and that's why we group them that way. So the most common of the low grades is follicular. So follicular lymphoma comes...
What I had.
Right, and it comes, that's the most common. And it comes in three grades, 1, 2, and 3. 3 is pretty uncommon. That's the one that's mostly large cell, and we do treat that as we would an aggressive lymphoma. But 1 and 2 are low grade. In fact, it's very hard for pathologists often to determine grade 1 versus 2, so we're sort of lumping them together because we don't really treat them any differently. So that's the most common. And follicular just means that under the microscope, it looks like follicles. A normal lymph node has follicles, which are little sort of circular areas of the cells under the microscope. They grow in sort of groups. And if it looks like that under the microscope, we say, okay, it's follicular. And then also there's some markers on the B cells that allow us to tell whether it's follicular center cell or follicular lymphoma versus one of the other types.
Mm-hmm.
The next most common of the indolence is called marginal zone, and that would be coming from a B cell that's around the follicle, so the margin, so that's the name of it. And the marginal zones are a little complicated because whereas follicular almost always is in a lymph node, marginal zone often is not in a lymph node. It's extranodal or outside the lymph node. And they can be in the spleen. So marginal comes in three types. In the node is actually the least common. And a splenic lymphoma is actually marginal zone that grows in the spleen. And then the extranodal marginals are the ones that people call MALT or mucosa-associated lymphoid tumors. And the most common of those is in the stomach. So the marginal zones are a little bit different than the folliculars in that they're usually outside lymph nodes in the spleen or commonly the GI tract, such as the stomach. They can be in the parotid gland. But they still behave, you know, indolently, slow-growing, and we can either leave them alone or treat them if they're acting up. And then the other kind that we see is called small lymphocytic lymphoma, And that's basically the same disease as chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL.
Mm-hmm.
So patients often get really confused, like, do I have leukemia or lymphoma? Well, you know, the cells are the same, and they circulate. So a lot of people with follicular lymphoma, if you do a bone marrow, the cells are there, and the cells, you can actually find them in the blood if you look hard enough. If the cells get to be high enough in the blood, you'll call it a leukemic phase of follicular lymphoma, but it's the same disease, and it still gets treated the same way. And the same thing with CLL or SLL, small lymphocytic lymphoma. The cells are the same, and if it's mostly in the blood, we call it CLL, and most of those patients do have small nodes, but if it's mostly in the nodes and the blood count's pretty normal, then you call it small lymphocytic lymphoma. So again, the line gets kind of blurry. So the three main types, marginal zone follicular and small lymphocytic. Then there's some rarer kinds, lymphoplasmacytic, which is also often Waldenstrom's, meaning it makes an abnormal protein, is another kind that people have separated out from other lymphomas, but really it's just an indolent B-cell lymphoma. So again, there are some rarer kinds, but those are the main types. But it's obviously, as I talk about it, you can hear it's quite confusing even for a lot of physicians to keep them straight and to know what they are. That's why we kind of group them into indolent and then approach them all the same way.
Well, you know, there are several different kinds. And Dr. Smith, how do you distinguish one type from another?
So the key in lymphoma is really the pathology and the pathologist. So you need to get an adequate biopsy, and we'll talk about what that means in a minute, and also it has to be studied properly. So a lot of this is done by looking under the microscope, but more and more it's done by what's called flow cytometry to see what's on the surface of the cells, and also by some chromosome studies.
This is Dr. Smith.
Dr.
Hello?
Smith? Oh, we got you
Hello.
Back.
Yeah, I don't know
Dr.
what happened
Smith?
There.
I am so sorry. I was just frantic trying to get in. We still have guests on the show who have stuck with us. I have no idea. You know, I noticed that there was a lot of static in the beginning, but you're much clearer now.
Okay, yeah, I switched to another phone. I just thought it was like a web thing, though, why there was static, but yeah. So,
well, I kind of wondered if it was the phone or what.
Right.
Thank you so much for your persistence. I appreciate it.
All right. I hope we didn't lose everybody.
Nope, we haven't lost everybody. They were very patient. I think they want to hear you.
All right.
And we were talking about distinguishing one type of lymphoma for another.
Right. So I think it's very important, number one, to get the correct biopsy. So the textbook answer and the Cancer Center Network guidelines call for an excisional biopsy, which means that you actually take out preferably all or at least a significant part of a lymph node. On occasion, when that's not possible, we will get a needle biopsy. If you get a needle biopsy, it's important not to just aspirate. They call it an FNA, fine needle aspiration. That's not enough. That's part of it to get the flow cytometry, but you really should get a core biopsy. And if that's okay and adequate, the pathologist should be able to tell what it is. But if after a needle biopsy, including the core needle, it's still an issue, then you should get a full node biopsy, because the pathology, as we talked about, really drives the choice of treatment. And then besides the actual adequacy of the biopsy, you want to have it reviewed by a pathologist who is an expert in this area, because as again, you heard me talk about earlier that all the different kinds of lymphomas, if someone doesn't do that routinely, they may not be up on all the techniques and the subtleties. And so it really is important to get an adequate biopsy and have it reviewed and interpreted by an expert hematopathologist. In fact, one of the main things when patients come to a cancer center like ours to get a second opinion is that the pathology that they bring those slides and we get our pathologist to review them, because often we do change the subtype of lymphoma and that might change the recommendation for treatment.
So after you get all these tests, you can then determine grade, stage, and something called FLIPI. What exactly is grade, stage, and FLIPI?
All right, yeah. So grade is whether it's low grade, intermediate grade, or high grade. So usually low grade or indolent versus aggressive. So you get the exact subtype, that gives you the grade. So that's, okay, you have an aggressive one, we're going to try to treat aggressively and cure, or you have the low grade and we're going to talk about watch and wait versus treatment. The stage is where in your body it is. Now, when you think about lung cancer, stage is critical because if it starts in the lung and moves out to lymph nodes and then later the rest of the body, that becomes a big difference in treatment. Lymphoma, especially the low grades, almost always are stage 3 and 4, meaning that they are throughout the body, above and below the diaphragm is stage 3, and if they're in the bone marrow, that's 4. So in contrast to many cancers, stage 3 and 4 is not a death sentence. In fact, it's the common thing, and it's rare, especially in the indolent lymphomas, to have stage 1 or 2. If you do have a 1 or 2, then occasionally we do radiation, and some people actually believe if there's anyone we cure with low-grade lymphoma, it's someone who presents with stage 1 who gets radiation and happens to not have disease elsewhere, but that's a pretty rare occurrence. So grade is what the type is, and it predicts fast or slow growing. Stage is where it is in your body, but again, stage in lymphoma is not as critical as it is in other kinds of cancer. So I always tell people when we're doing the bone marrow, don't get freaked if the bone marrow comes back positive. We expect that it is. You have low-grade lymphoma, and it's probably in there. Now, the flippy, so, you know, it's fine to say, oh, you have an average survival of so many years, but people want to know, that's average. Can you tell me a little bit more about my disease? And the flippy is an attempt to do that. It stands for Follicular Lymphoma International Prognostic Index.
So, is there not a flippy 2 now, or is there? Dr. Smith?
Hello, I'm getting some...
Okay, I'm here.
Okay,
I'm here.
I got something about muted, not muted. Okay. Anyway,
okay.
So the problem with flippy is the data, it was all before Rituxan was around.
Mm-hmm.
And now the flippy 2 is very similar to the flippy, but it... because people haven't been followed long enough, so it includes patients treated with Rituxan, but it talks about how long it is before the disease comes back. So if you get treated, it says how long before your disease comes back and needs to be treated again. And that may not be so much what we're interested in as how long you're going to live over the series of different treatments. So flippy 2 is interesting. I must tell you that neither of these factors into treatment decisions. It tries to help you decide whether you might need treatment sooner or later. Maybe we tend to treat the higher risk patients a little more aggressively. But mostly it allows us when we do clinical trials to make sure that we're not picking only the best patients or only the worst patients and making wrong conclusions about how good the treatment is. So clinically, to be honest with you, most of us don't do that. Most of us don't make any treatment decisions based on flippy or flippy 2. So don't obsess over that.
So patients don't really need to put a whole lot of importance on their flippy score.
Exactly.
Okay. That's good to know. Because I do hear of patients sometimes who just really do believe that the higher score is a death sentence. And you know, it's good to know that they're... But it isn't.
Right, it isn't. So, yes, you shouldn't worry about that. That's what I mean. Stage and flippy are things we put in our back pocket and think about, but there's no reason to get too freaked out if you're stage 4 and high flippy score. You still might go for years and not need treatment.
Right,
so
okay. Good to
the
know.
The most important thing is how fast or slow your lymphoma is growing. That's really the thing which really defines how well you're going to do. And then if you do get treated, how long the remission lasts. So, you know, if you go 4 years before you need treatment, get one treatment and go another 4 years, you know you're going to do well for a long time. The patients we worry about are patients who come in and have lots of symptoms, need treatment right away, get a good treatment, and maybe a year, a year and a half later, the disease is back. Those are the patients we get concerned about and think that perhaps we should be looking at some more intensive therapy or experimental therapy, those sorts of issues.
Well, it's sort of, I was in that position. I put my doctor to the test. I was refractory to the first two types of chemotherapy that he gave me, and so I never finished a treatment of either one completely.
Wow.
So it was lots of fun, but here I am 7 years later, and I'm fine.
Right,
so,
and I think that's the thing.
It's certainly an individual case.
Right, and because you say, well, if two chemos didn't work, then your cells are telling us they're resistant to standard things, but then you go with a biologic therapy, and wow, they're very sensitive to biologic therapy.
Right.
And that's,
I think
that's
at that point it's logical to treat with a different mechanism.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what we do. Even when we choose chemo, if it didn't, we don't want to choose drugs in the same that work in the same way. If one didn't work, we'll choose a drug that works in a different way and try to attack it that way. And the same thing with the biologics.
Well, we're sort of jumping ahead into treatment plans, but before we go there, you touched on something that I was going to ask you, and you mentioned that these indolent lymphomas really aren't considered curable. But just from a patient perspective, for anybody who's out there listening and who may be really new to this whole lymphoma community, you know, I just want to add that there are many people who, like me, have been in remission for years, and yet our doctors hesitate to use that word cure. So I just want to repeat something that I've often said, and that is, as treatments have improved over the years and we're living longer, maybe we're putting a little bit too much emphasis on that cure word, and maybe we should focus on the fact that we can heal even if we're not necessarily cured. Would you sort of agree with that?
I think that's a perfect way of phrasing it. Cure, we mean goes away, stays away, never going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really care. If we can detect a few cells and they're not bothering you, that's all right. If we can say it's going to be in remission for 5 years, we'll have new treatments then that's fine too. I mean, we don't cure hypertension, we don't cure diabetes, and people live with them and they don't have that same fear of saying this is incurable. The other thing I always tell patients is, patients live for, many, many, many years with these. So before we can talk about a cure, we have to follow a lot of patients out 15, 20, 25 years.
Sure.
So we may be curing people today, and we just don't know it. We're not confident enough to say it. And 10 years from now, we may say, oh, you know what? When we started doing that back in 2000, we started to cure some patients. But we won't know that for another, 5, 10 years at least.
Right.
So, I think
it's a generation.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think it's not like, it's not wishful thinking. It's not like, oh, you have a type of disease that's going to kill you in 6 months. You don't realistically think that the magic is going to come along in 6 months. But if you say, I'm going to live for 10 years, the sky's the limit in terms of what treatments are going to be around 5 or 10 years from now that we don't have today. So, I try not to get anyone to focus on curable or not. Just, you're going to live for a long time with this, and we're going to keep coming up with new things.
Well, it's true. I mean, even since 2002, when I was first diagnosed, I'm amazed at what's come out. It's mind-boggling.
It is, and every couple
of
years, new drugs. I mean, you think about the new drugs that have come out in the last couple of years for various types of lymphoma, and that those are approved, and so many more that we know are in the pipeline. That I think it's very likely that patients will go from one treatment to the next, and do well for a long time.
Right. Well, Dr. Smith, let's get into some treatment plans. With the various types, grades, and stages, surely treatment plans vary, and I know from my own experience that there really is a smorgasbord of options. And also, according to the studies that I've read, there seems to be evidence that achieving a complete response is an important factor for extending remission periods. And if that's true, given all the options, how in the world do you formulate a treatment plan, and how do patients decide with their doctors which is best?
Yeah, this is an area of medicine where I think the art of medicine really comes in, because there is no right answer. There's a whole long list, and the guidelines list many, and there's always research studies and things. So I think the main thing, well, first of all, I tell patients, you will probably get many of these treatments over time, so we want to make the best decision on the first treatment, but we shouldn't obsess too much, because you know, if you get treatment A first and B second, or B first and A second, it may not make such a difference. But on the other hand, we do want to put it in remission as long as possible, and that's really the key. But we want to do it in a way that doesn't injure the patient in terms of toxicity or burn any bridges in terms of, gee, I had so many side effects from this that I can't get the next treatment because my body won't take it. So there's a balance. Otherwise, we'd say, well, we'll do it aggressively, and, you know, we'll get the longest remission. So there's no question that, you know, if you give rituximab or rituximab plus chemotherapy, you'll probably do longer remission with rituximab chemo, but the trade-off is the side effects are worse. So that's the trade-off. And everyone has a different level of, you know, risk that they want to take. And again, if you have a lot of other medical problems, a bad heart, severe diabetes, we might want to avoid certain drugs and go gentler. If you're younger and healthier and we think you can tolerate the more intensive therapy without any, you know, significant problems, we might go a little more aggressively. So it's really individualized.
Mm-hmm.
The big question today is always, do I need Adriamycin or not? Do I get R-CHOP or RCVP?
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, you know, R-CHOP will probably put you in remission longer than RCVP, but then down the line, you may have burned some bridges because you really can't get Adriamycin again because of the concerns of heart toxicity. So what happens if your low-grade lymphoma becomes aggressive and you need Adriamycin? And so that's one of my concerns. So I tend to use more RCVP, but there are other of my colleagues who are look at the same data and give more R-CHOP. So that's a really hard one for patients because doctors can't even decide.
I think there's so much to going back to what you said, weighing risk versus benefit and looking at each individual case. But really, what are the main choices of a first-line therapy? And I know you've mentioned R-CHOP or RCVP. What about watch and wait?
Right. So this is all what I was talking about was only if you've decided you need treatment. So we do, lymphoma doctors still watch many patients with this disease because the argument or the thought process is if you're not having symptoms, the disease is growing slowly, if I treat you just to make your CAT scan look better or to shrink some lymph nodes that we can feel but aren't bothering you, I'm not really helping you in the long run, and I might be, you know, causing some problems or using up some treatments we might want later or making you ineligible for a new treatment that comes along down the line. So if the disease is not symptomatic and it's growing slowly, we usually don't recommend treatment, and on average, such patients, if they don't need treatment when they are first diagnosed, can go for many years. On average, it's 3 to 4 years without needing treatment. And if you walk in the door today with a new diagnosis of follicular lymphoma and don't need treatment, in 3 or 4 years, we should have new treatment. So there's benefit in waiting, and there's never been shown to be a benefit in treating early rather than waiting. So watch and wait. It's been studied pretty well. Doesn't risk anything as long as you're followed closely and treatment is started as the disease starts to pick up the pace or is about to cause trouble, maybe sort of taking over the bone marrow and your blood counts are getting lower because, you know, the bad cells are overgrowing it. Those are indications for treatment. But if you're feeling fine and your counts are normal or stable, then watch and wait is a very viable option. And later on, as it becomes symptomatic or about to cause trouble, then you go into the decision process of, you know, how aggressive should we be with this particular disease. And then you've had a chance to watch the disease and see how it grows. And if it's growing slowly and not causing much trouble, you know, you might use Rituxan alone. If it's growing faster, you're starting to have more symptoms, maybe add the Rituxan plus chemo decision. So that's sort of the, you know, but again, it's very individualized. It's hard to make up rules.
Yeah. You mentioned something that I want to make sure that I heard you clearly and just repeat it for anybody who's listening. did I hear you say that there's nothing out there that suggests that treating earlier is any better than watching and waiting and then treating as necessary?
That's correct. There have been a number of trials over the years that have looked at that, early treatment versus late, and there's never been a change in the overall survival. Now, the thing that changed the equation a little bit is rituximab, because now you say, gee, rituximab's pretty easy, and it's not very toxic, and, you know, why don't I give it early? But even there's never been a trial that shows that early treatment is better than later treatment. Now, there is a trial such as asking that question in England, but it'll be a few years before we know the results of that. It would be a hard study to do in this country, because who would want to be randomly assigned to treatment now or treatment later? You know, that's a hard one to do, but that would be the question. But up until now, multiple studies over the years have never shown that treating early is any better than waiting and treating when you need to start to have symptoms.
Great. Well, I appreciate your just clarifying that there. You know, it's always a tough call for patients, I think, who need to decide, gosh, can I live with hearing, oh, you have cancer, but we're not going to do anything about it.
That's the hardest thing to do.
I really wanted for you to clarify that for anybody who's listening who may be dealing with that thought right now. So,
right. No, that's a common one. It's a really difficult thing for patients to get the idea, I have this cancer, but you don't want to do anything. It goes counter to everything that we've taught patients over the years about cancer.
Right.
And usually what happens is you get the diagnosis, you're all frantic, and then we see you in a couple months and you begin to realize that, you know, gee, I'm not sick and I'm doing all right. And then over time, it takes some patients 6 to 12 months to get used to that idea. You know, it's not something that you usually embrace the first time the doctor tells you that, but it takes several visits and sort of this confidence in the doctor, and that you watch yourself and you say, hey, I'm still doing all right. I'm still doing my activities. I can live like this. But it does take time to get used to.
It does. Well, thanks for clarifying that. Let's go on to the choices that patients have if they relapse or if they're refractory.
Okay, so for relapse, a lot depends on how long it's been since your last treatment. If you use, say, RCVP, and 4 years later the disease is back, you can do the same thing again. So that's just one more thing. If you relapse within a year, or maybe even a year or two, or you're actually refractory, then, as we talked about earlier, you wouldn't go back to that same treatment. You try to choose something else. And the combinations that have come out over the past few years are just expanding. So it used to be you got something like RCVP or R-CHOP. Then you might get a drug called fludarabine, which works in a different way. And then you were sort of running out of options. Nowadays, of course, you can get Rituxan over and over. In the last couple of years, bendamustine has been approved. Bortezomib or Velcade is approved for mantle cell that works in all sorts of lymphomas. A drug called Revlimid has activity. It's sometimes hard to get it paid for because it's a pill and you get it from the pharmacy. There's research studies. As you well know, the radioactive antibodies, Zevalin and Bexxar, are very active. So there are many choices. And again, it's individualized. How's your disease behaving? You know, what's my organ function? If my kidney is bad, I might stay away from certain drugs that damage that. If I have diabetes and neuropathy, I might want to stay away from that drug, vincristine, you know, or so you make those choices based on the patient, there's what's happened to them before. But there are many, many choices. And it is always possible, with the sort of exception of Adriamycin, to go back to a treatment that you had before. Maybe you had treatment one and then treatment two and then treatment three. And by that time, it's a number of years later, you can go back to number one again and may get some mileage. So all of those are possible. And again, it sort of depends on what you've had before as to what your choices are. And the other thing we should consider also a stem cell transplant, which is a very intensive treatment. But, you know, if you have fairly resistant disease, that can be an effective treatment for this. We don't usually use it because we don't need such intensive therapy. But if you've had two or three treatments and your disease is behaving a little more aggressively, it's not not crazy to sometimes explore that option as well.
You know, one of the things that I've always thought about having the lymphomas, and of course nobody likes to have cancer, but if I had to have cancer, the good news with the indolent lymphoma is that there are choices. And usually when one thing doesn't work, something else will. So I think that really enables us to have a lot of hope and to live with this disease very well for very long periods of time.
Right, and I think that's exactly right. You stated it well, is that, you know, we never, it's a little hard to predict and there's some uncertainty, but there's always something new around the corner and we have a lot of things that we already have. So there are many choices and it's really trying to pick at each time, do I need treatment? And if so, what's the best treatment for me given my entire situation at that time?
Dr. Smith, let's talk about maintenance therapy, if you would, for a minute. What is the goal of maintenance therapy? And again, you know, when is that appropriate?
Yeah. So, you know, with chemotherapy, usually after about 6 months of treatment, both the patient and the doctor have about had it. And, you know, you need a break. But with rituximab, it, you know, it raises the question of giving rituximab treatment. And so now we say, gee, you had, say, Rituxan and CVP, and you've had 6 or 8 treatments, and you're in remission, but we say you're not cured. We know there's disease somewhere. What if we continue to give you rituximab as a maintenance to try to keep the disease under control? And there are a number of ways that that's been done. And it's pretty clear that it will keep the disease away longer if you keep getting rituximab than if you don't. Now, whether that changes, whether that's better than waiting for the disease to come back and getting rituximab again, is a question that's still sort of an open question. There was a press release a few weeks ago, this thing called the PRIMA trial, which is in Europe, where everyone got rituximab plus chemotherapy. Most of them actually got rituximab CHOP. And then they either got rituximab or observation. And even if they got rituximab with their chemo, when they got rituximab maintenance, the disease stayed away longer. The trial's not mature enough for us to say whether it makes any difference in the long run. But if you want your disease to stay away longer, then getting some maintenance rituximab makes sense. And which dose and schedule is really... probably, in my mind, I doubt it makes a big difference. That we just don't know what the best way of giving it. Some people give it one day every 3 months. Some people give it weekly for 4 weeks, every 6 months. There's rationale for both of those, but we just don't know. And all the trials have had different doses and schedules. But I think maintenance therapy makes sense. Other people say, you know what, my disease is in remission. I don't want to be thinking about it, have treatment, leave me alone. When it comes back, I'll deal with it. And so they wouldn't go on maintenance. But there are concerns about maintenance. You know, long-term rituximab might, in theory at least, reduce your immune system to the point where you start to see infections and things. So it's not without any side effects, but most people tolerate it well. And usually we give maintenance for about 2 years and then stop at that point in hopes that when your disease does come back, it'll still be sensitive to rituximab and you won't have these potential long-term side effects.
So again, it's really sitting down with your doctor and deciding what the best course is for each individual person, it sounds like.
Absolutely. There are no rules is the rule.
No rules, exactly.
No
Boy,
rules.
Did I learn that. you know, Dr. Smith, as a matter of disclosure to you and our audience, and I've already mentioned this, a treatment called radioimmunotherapy, or RIT, rescued me 7 years ago after all else failed. And I've been healthy ever since. So it's disturbing to me when I read articles, and there have been numerous of them, articles that have indicated that the two RIT drugs, Bexxar and Zevalin, have been underutilized. In fact, there was an Associated Press article on June 5th in 2007 entitled "Smart Bomb Drugs for Lymphoma Underused," and you're quoted as saying, "There's lots of reasons to use them and seems to be an inertia to use them. I do see it as unfortunate." So my question is, what should the role of RIT be? And will the recent approval of Zevalin in consolidation with chemo as frontline treatment, do you think that will make a difference?
I hope so. I think they are underused. I don't think there's any question they're underused. You know, these drugs have high response rates. 70-80% of patients will respond. Their disease will shrink, not necessarily all the way, but they will shrink. They're very easy drugs. They're basically a treatment like rituximab, 2 weeks, you know, one week and then a week later, and you're done. And so they're easy treatments. There's a high response rate, and there are a number of patients, as you seem to be, who are out many years without any evidence of disease. And these are the kinds of patients that, you know, we don't want to use the cure word, but who knows? And I think the plateau looks like it's at around 20 to 25% of patients really out more than 5 years doing well. And it's an easy treatment. Some of the hurdles are that it's not as easy to give because if I order someone, you know, Zevalin, we have to order it from a pharmacy, a radio pharmacy that actually knows how to work with radioactive material, shipped in a special way, has to be timed to get here at the right time. We have to have the nuclear medicine person. So there's a lot of coordination that goes into it, but that shouldn't really be a hindrance. And unfortunately, because of, you know, those logistical problems and some cost issues, they are and have been underused. I think they should always be, you know, in relapse setting, you know, certainly in the discussion. And I'm hoping that this recent approval, which based on a trial where if you got chemotherapy and got into remission and then randomized to get Zevalin or not, the disease stayed away longer if you got the Zevalin. Now, there are some things about that study that aren't perfect. Only about, you know, 1 out of 7 of the patients got Rituxan with their chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And these days, a lot of people use Rituxan maintenance. So what if you should really be comparing Zevalin to Rituxan maintenance and things like that. But the bottom line is it's been approved and it makes sense. And I'm hoping now that the companies that are doing this will put more effort, and clearly they are. They're putting more effort into, you know, getting them out into the community. You know, we do this a lot, and we'd be happy to treat patients so that even if they're getting treatment from another doctor and they get referred to us for Zevalin, you know, we're happy to do that, and most centers are. We actually have a trial of Zevalin plus a drug called gemcitabine. Gemcitabine is used as a radiation sensitizer if you're getting regular radiation, so we think maybe it'll make the Zevalin radiation work better. So we're still very interested in trying to improve on these drugs and how to use them. We actually did a trial from ECOG, Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, in mantle cell lymphoma, the same kind of thing where you got R-CHOP and then got Zevalin, and we were, you know, it wasn't magic, but it definitely gave pretty good results and was well tolerated. So I like the idea of consolidation, and I like the idea that the drugs are going to be available more widely because of this indication. So I think it's worth a question to your doctor, you know, am I a candidate? There are side effects. There are potential long-term risks that have made people concerned about it, but they're very effective and pretty, you know, patient-friendly.
Well, I can vouch for that after having chemo.
Right.
Very, very patient-friendly. And you also alluded to some common concerns. And if anybody's out there, I don't want to spend too much time on RIT, but if anybody is out there who is listening and wants to know more, I've got a whole section on my website about radioimmunotherapy, lots of myths and facts, and the whole thing has been vetted by medical professionals, so you can certainly go there, and that website is www.lymphomabook, and just look under the section on radioimmunotherapy. There's links to all kinds of studies and charts and graphs and pictures and whatnot. So anyway, thank you for that. And
all right, that would be a good use resource because, as I say, that's one thing where sometimes the patient has to be an advocate to say, hey, why aren't I hearing about this as an option?
Right. Well, let's move on and talk about some clinical trials. I understand that the percentage of adults who participate in trials is about 4%, and that's for all kinds of cancers, which is pretty dismal. So my question is, when should patients consider clinical trials, and do you have any idea how to encourage more patients to participate in them so that people like you can make better headway faster?
Right. Well, I think that is key. With, you know, there are lots of trials now, especially, you know, lymphoma is not that common, and there's lots of potential drugs and lots of good trials, and we, you know, it is slowed by the fact that, you know, not as many patients as we think are eligible would actually go on a trial. So I think in lymphoma, in indolent lymphoma in particular, it's always a good idea to do some research and see what clinical trials are out there. You can ask your doctor. There's clinicaltrials.gov website, and you can put in the type of disease and where you are and what stage. You can look for ones just near you or anywhere around the country. So it's a pretty reasonable way to do it. And, you know, a lot of these new drugs, especially if they're targeted biologic therapies, make a lot of sense. And it's not like in some diseases where, gee, I don't have time to look. You have usually a window where you can look around and find and go explore and talk to people about what's out there. And it's really the best way for us to make progress and figure out these combinations and things like that. People have some misconceptions about clinical trials, that they're going to get a placebo. That's not true in cancer trials.
Right.
You know,
or they're going to get less than standard of care.
Right.
I think that's another misconception. So if you could address that one as well.
Right. So we always think, and there's actually a number of studies which have shown, that people in clinical trials get better care. They're monitored very closely according to set guidelines. They don't slip through the cracks of the medical system. So they get better care. If it's a phase three trial, which is sort of the last stage, is a randomized trial, you're always at That usually compares two different treatments. One of the arms is the best standard care that we have, and the other is either that plus something or something that at least has reason to believe that it's as good or better. So you're always getting good care. There are phase two trials where we might treat 30 or 40 patients, but again, talk to the doctor, but usually these are drugs which, especially in lymphoma, have a real rationale behind them and a fair amount of data. If you don't qualify for those, the phase one studies, those are the more experimental, the drugs haven't really been given to very many patients, if any, we're trying to learn about them. Those are a little riskier. But again, if it's a biologic treatment like a new antibody, say it might be something that's very similar to rituximab, they have to go through those stages, but we know that it's going to be pretty safe. So you really have to talk about the specifics of the trial and understand it. And there's, unfortunately, these very complicated consent forms that are usually 10 or 20 pages.
I started out in a clinical trial, so how well I remember.
Right. And we're obligated, as you probably saw, you know, every potential side effect is listed, and so it's a little scary for patients. But, you know, you have to look at what the alternative is. And if you looked at every side effect of any drug, you know, if you had to list everything that ever been possibly reported, it looks a little scary. So it really, you need to talk to the doctor and say, what can I really expect? And is this reasonable? And I'm not saying that everyone should be on one and that every trial is right for you, but you should really be thinking about them because some, you know, rituximab, you know, or Zevalin, when you get them early on, they're magic drugs, and, you know, you wouldn't have had them if you weren't on a clinical trial at that point. So, you know, you really have an opportunity to help advance the field and get good treatment. So don't be scared off by the consent form. Get it sort of in layman's terms from the doctor and or the nurse. And know what you're signing up for, but, you know, it will be a good treatment or a reasonable treatment. And you know, probably or often it's going to be less toxic for lymphoma than like R-CHOP or something like that would be. The other hindrance, unfortunately, is more logistical. If you live 3 hours away from the cancer center where the trial is, and it requires visits two or three times a week, you know, sometimes patients just can't do that, and so sometimes that's a problem. But again, there are a lot of trials in community cancer centers, a lot of group national trials that your doctor might be able to hook into, and treat you on a study even in your local doctor's office. So it takes a little effort, but we think it's worth it, and really that's where the advances have come from.
Well, it's true, and I've met several people who participated in clinical trials for both Rituxan and Bexxar and Zevalin, and I always want to hug them and say, you know, gee, you did a great part by partnering with the scientists who made these drugs possible. So I think clinical trials are really something that I wish more people would consider when it's possible for them, because it will really advance the science faster. So I appreciate your explanation of that, because I think some people are, there are a lot of common misconceptions, the placebos and the other things you mentioned. So, no, we're not getting placebos.
Correct.
You're the principal investigator for several trials at Fox Chase. Would you like to tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. So we, you know, for instance, we talked about indolent lymphoma and whether it's RCVP or RCHOP. So we, again, going more biologic, our current trial actually is rituximab and bortezomib, better known as Velcade. So not any chemotherapy per se. It's a phase 2 trial, so everyone gets those two drugs and they know exactly what they're getting. We've been, you know, we're pleased with the results so far. And our next trial will build on that. It'll probably be those two plus a third drug, which I'm currently negotiating with the drug company for, to try to improve that. Again, another sort of biologic agent, trying to get a cocktail of two or three agents, but not chemo. So that's sort of the direction we're going for indolent, if you've never had treatment. And then if you've had treatment, again, we're looking at a number of things. We have the trial with Zevalin, which I think makes a lot of sense. The Zevalin with the gemcitabine chemo is really a very low dose. It doesn't even have much in the way of chemo side effects. It's really a low dose to make the Zevalin work better.
And that's for mantle cell, if I recall?
Well, that's actually for any type. For mantle cell, we have a number of trials in development nationally that we're going to be opening soon. One will be rituximab, the drug bendamustine, otherwise known as Treanda, and Velcade. So again, getting away from the CVP and CHOP era into these other agents. And for relapsed mantle cell, again, mantle cell sort of has the worst features of aggressive and low grade. It's not considered curable, but it grows a lot faster in many patients, at least, than most of the indolents. And so we are looking at there's a class of drugs called mTOR, M-T-O-R inhibitors, that seem to have activity, and there's a new one in pill form that we're studying in mantle cell. So that would be our, you know, you've had mantle cell, the disease has come back. We've had a series of mantle cell studies. I mentioned the RCHOP Zevalin one. More recently, it's an RCHOP variation with Velcade. So trying to improve on the RCHOP by either adding something at the end or adding something to it. Now we're going to get away from the RCHOP and go to the R-bendamustine for upfront treatment. But then if you relapse, you have this mTOR drugs. Velcade is very active in mantle cell. Revlimid, there's a trial of Revlimid going on for mantle cell. So a lot of activity in mantle cell these days. And the other drug that we're really interested in is this anti-CD22 antibody with a drug, so an immunoconjugate antibody targets the drug right to the cell. So if you think about Rituxan, it has to bind to the cell, and then the body has to figure out how to kill the cell. Here we use the antibody to, just like targeting the radiation to the cell, this targets a drug to the cell. And that's a very active drug, and we'll be about to open a study in relapsed low-grade with that drug. So again, there's always new ones. I mean, we're always thinking, you know, 6 to 12 months in advance, because it can take a while to get a study up and open. So we have one open, we say it's going to close in 6 months. We are thinking now about what the new one's going to be.
Well, it sounds like maybe someday chemotherapy might be a thing of the past.
That is our
and that Absolutely. Would be, I think that's a lot of patients' hopes too, you know, because certainly
Absolutely.
These biologics are much easier to take, and, you know, if we can, you know, if they're more effective and easier, great. That's wonderful.
Absolutely, yes. We agree with that. And, you know, when you look at the what's happened to lymphoma over the last 10 or 12 years with the radioimmunotherapy and rituximab, you know, we are really seeing, you know, concrete results with the low-grade lymphomas. Clearly, patients
sure.
are living longer with better quality of life than they did, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So, you know, it's a real, not just a theoretic advance.
Yeah, a lot of us are living proof.
We'd love to hear that, too.
In wrapping up, Dr. Smith, do you have any message or thoughts that you'd like to share with the audience? Could be absolutely anything you'd like to say.
Well, I just think, you know, you really have to think about this as a chronic disease. We are actively investigating lots of new agents, as we've talked about. And, you know, I just think that it's an exciting time to be in this field as a physician with all these new drugs and possibilities. And, you know, I think that should translate to the patients out there to say, you know, this is a serious disease. We don't want to minimize it, but the advances are coming so quickly, and we've made such advances in the last 5 or 10 years, and they'll continue at that pace or faster, that you shouldn't be focusing on, you know, oh, my average survival is X, but, you know, if I make it 5 or 10 years, there's going to be a whole new series of treatments opening up, and those are realistic goals. And try not to be focusing on, you know, all the downsides. You're going to live with disease for a long time, and you should enjoy your life and live it. Yeah, you can't ignore it, but if you focus only on the disease, it really, you let the disease get the better of you, and you really have to just enjoy life, and none of us know what the future holds, so you should enjoy that and take care of yourself, but not focus all your energy on the disease.
You know, that's a perfect thought to end on. It's just so upbeat and full of hope. And I think with these indolent lymphomas and the treatments that are available, there's concrete reason to have hope.
Absolutely.
So that's perfect. Perfect. Dr. Smith, I remember when I was first diagnosed, now almost 8 years ago, and frantically trying to understand lymphoma. So I know firsthand that the information you shared with us will be just enormously helpful to anyone who's listening and who is just starting this journey. And it's a great refresher for those of us who've lived with lymphoma for years. I guess we have to call ourselves the lymphoma veterans. So I thank you for being with us tonight and for sharing your time and expertise and for teaching us about the indolent lymphomas and their treatments, and really, as I said, for giving us reasons to remain hopeful.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Smith, I can't let this opportunity pass without thanking you for one more thing. And that's really the work that you do every day, day in and day out, that gives people like me and our listeners the chance to dance at our grandchildren's weddings. And I'm being kind of serious here because it is serious. We truly do owe a debt of gratitude to you and scientists like you for choosing to spend your lives making ours better. So I just wanted to really say thank you from the bottom of my heart for that.
You're welcome, and I appreciate the thought.
All righty. If you will stay with me for just a minute.
Okay.
I also want to thank our audience for tuning in. I truly apologize for whatever audio problems we had. I know that you all have enjoyed the show as much as I have. This is Betsy DePerry in Ann Arbor, Michigan, wishing you all an abundance of love and laughter, and good night, all.